Open your minds. Open your hearts. And listen to that voice in the back of your head. That voice the world has tried to silence, has tried to teach you to ignore. The voice of our angel telling you, be not afraid.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fear Response Podcast. I'm Jenna.
And I'm John.
Welcome back to another episode of our Midnight Mass series. And in this one, we're talking about the penultimate episode.
Called Apostles?
Yeah, Acts of the Apostles.
Acts of the Apostles, okay. Very, very interesting and very action-packed episode, which I think is part of what sets it apart.
It is. And it's got one of my favorite kind of aspects that movies and narratives can have, which is forced into a team situation.
True. Yeah. And what a team.
Yeah. What a team indeed. And there's one part specifically, it's like a handful of frames. It's not much, but of all of our heroes together. And I just love it. I just love it.
Okay. Well, I'll see if I can guess when and what it is as we go.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I love all the characters we've been introduced to.
Spent time with.
And then by the end of this episode, the random few that have been whittled down to be our heroes for the last act is really cool.
Yeah, and they all come from kind of a different place, yeah, too.
Some of them haven't really interacted perhaps at all up until this point, and yet they are heroes at the end, which we'll come to that.
Yeah, and it's been interesting discussing this series because I started in such a different place from where I'm ending, mm-hmm, in terms of the way I'm looking at everyone, particularly Father Paul.
Yes, even after having watched it before. And one thing, I was honestly a bit embarrassed listening back to the episodes, because I listened to, I believe, our first one, and we're talking about Riley, and we say to each other, like, oh, would you call him a hero? And we both kind of hem and haw and ultimately kind of land on, no, not really.
Right.
But then by the time we actually got through the series and watched the previous episode, mm-hmm, my opinion is absolutely, yes, he is a selfless hero. That was my thought at the end.
Because he tries to make all the right steps to, yep, save who he can by going through Aaron.
And he's trying his absolute utmost to be a good person.
That's true. I mean, we know that.
He's done He's done something bad in the past, but for as long as we've known him, as long as we've seen him on screen, he was trying his absolute best to do no harm, help those that he could.
Mm-hmm.
Be unobtrusive, be a good person in the best way that he knows how for the every bit that we saw. And ultimately, his final act being extremely self-sacrificing, obviously. He used his last moments to try to help those people.
Yeah, that's a good point. And he clearly had intentions to help as many people as he could by doing that.
He could have gone on being a vampire and making do, you know, selfishly to try to just eke out a few more days, months, weeks of life.
Yeah.
That many people would do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, he was trying his best. If that makes him a hero, then that's good. That probably applies to a lot of people.
Yeah, like, if our standard for being a hero is trying your best.
Just do your best, buddy.
Yeah, let's say that.
You're a hero.
That. Yeah, just do your best.
He does. So the last scene we saw in the last episode was him in the boat bursting into flames. We got a really cool Saint Maud moment with Aaron. And Catherine Siegel was just going wild with the screaming, and she did a great job of that.
And then by the time we see her, our opening shots of this episode are her looking just absolutely shell-shocked.
I was thinking, yeah, more listless, but calm. So obviously that's probably a bit of a traumatic response, a shock response that she's in, but she wasn't apoplectic anymore. That's for sure. How long it took, who knows?
So here, let me speak to that. So something that we encounter often in my line of work is really heightened emotion and extreme behavior related to that, right? So people being really angry, really sad, really scared, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so the extreme behaviors that come with that, yelling, screaming, crying, you know, moving their bodies a lot, hitting walls, whatever it might be in that time of distress. An important thing to remember, especially as a caregiver, when you think like, ooh, I have to act, what do I have to do? Is to remember that that level of energy cannot be sustained. There is an end to it. Because I think that sometimes what we see when we see someone, you know, that upset, we think, oh my gosh, I have to get in there. I have to talk to them. I have to give them a medication. I have to this and that.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best thing to do is nothing. Maybe your presence would just make them more angry. Maybe they're in a state where they might do something they don't want to do, like, you know, try to hit you because they're that upset or whatever. So maybe the best thing to do, if they're in a safe place, is just to leave them, because that energy can't be sustained. Eventually there will come a point where they calm down and everyone is maybe then in a better place to talk. That's not to say you don't offer things first, because of course you do when someone's upset. If you think you can help when someone's upset, of course try.
Sure.
But there are times that you just need to kind of let it burn itself out. And I think that that's what we see with her. We saw she was absolutely screaming. Mm-hmm. She was out of her head. She was acting completely in a very heightened way. And then so by the time we see her at the beginning of this episode, that is spent. She's all done.
Spent would be the word.
Yeah.
And I agree. And I think that's important for people to know, because even when I'm speaking to people about anxiety, we'll talk about a time or a thing that might make someone a 10 out of 10 anxious, right? And it's just important to know that that level of anxiety even can't sustain either. So if you're in a place where you have to be, but you don't want to be because you're so anxious to be there, obviously there will be a lot of front loading with big feelings of anxiety, but the body just can't stay at that level. You know what I mean? It's like, it just wouldn't have the energy to do so.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, this too shall pass. It's a thing that you can remind yourself of that's going to be helpful in those kind of situations.
Yes, and it can be helpful, you know, not to be dismissive of anyone's experience with anxiety. Yeah. But, you know, there's another side of the coin to, if there's something that you're really motivated to do, even if you're very anxious, even if you're feeling sick, all the rest, the more time you spend there, it'll naturally start to wane. And obviously, again, you can do things to help that. You can use some of your coping strategies, anything like that. Other things could happen to bring you back up, but, you know, it's not going to stay peaked like that. It's just not really possible.
And so we see her kind of collect herself, wipes her nose, picks up her oars, and rows back to shore.
Yeah, works up the courage and the strength to row back. She seemed like she was out quite a far way.
I guess the idea is that they're island people. That's the kind of thing that they do.
That's what they do. We see Father Paul stood pensive on his porch, and the family as well. So this is a bit of a carryover from the last episode. The Flynn family waking up to their letters that were left by Riley. And so we see Ed kind of picking up his and that sort of thing. And again, this came up when we were talking about the conversations with Aaron and Hassan, but obviously very evocative of suicide, which ultimately that's what Riley did. Even though it's a pretty extreme case. But yeah, I just thought another parallel with them waking up to the kind of final goodbye letter from Riley.
Would you consider that a suicide though? Because would you say that about something like, for example, a rescuer staying behind during a hurricane when other people are helicoptered out because he thinks I'm going to stay behind and maybe help more people? And knows that he'll likely die. Would you consider it to be a suicide then?
I don't know. I mean, it's such an extreme case. It probably doesn't bear being classified. I think that it has most of the hallmarks, but it's another situation too. What if you had a terminal illness and you chose not to treat it, which is essentially also what's happening to him, because he has vampirism and he's just waiting for the sun to come up. I mean, it's certainly on the borderline, but he knew he was going to do it. He had time to prepare and hence all the letters and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aaron is walking on the island. Do you think that she's looking at Sturge with kind of judgment as he's sorting out the sign for the midnight mass?
I think so too. I think so for sure.
Yeah, that was your impression, right?
And yeah, she also has a very fun, she's got a vacant expression, I would probably.
Almost looks kind of stern, you know?
Yeah, and then so he gets the sense that she's looking for him a bit too long, so he waves. And she does wave back, which I thought was kind of cute, I don't know. I
feel kind of bad for Sturge a little bit. Like, he seems like kind of simple in a way that he could be maybe easily manipulated.
I think Sturge is a stooge.
Pretty much, yeah.
Maybe that's where they got the name.
Maybe it is. It sounds very boat-like. Is there like a word that I'm just missing?
Like starboard?
They're stern.
The bow and the stern.
It's like a mix of stern and bilge. Those are both boat words.
What's bilge?
I think the bilge is the part underneath the bottom floor of the boat that, like, is still an empty air pocket and maybe even takes on water at times, but it's, like, underneath the floor.
Mm.
What the hell do I know? I could be very wrong about that. Ed's reading the letter, looking very disheartened. Like, what do you think it said? I don't think they ever explain it.
Ed does somewhat.
Yeah.
It says the truth as Riley knows it.
Yeah, because he does allude later to Father Paul that he couldn't understand, he couldn't reconcile what was in that letter. So clearly he's like, hey, this is what's going on.
He says he's not well. Like, I think that I think that he thinks these are delusions that he's reading.
And we also cut to Aaron, who's now trying to explain to Sarah, Dr. Sarah, what's been going on. Why do you think she goes to her?
I think she goes to her because Riley was her best friend. And the other person that she's probably closest to is Sarah, because she was seeing her throughout her whole pregnancy.
Often, yeah.
And I think also because she thinks that she is logical, calm, dependable, and a good listener, probably. So she goes straight to her house, which she is. Yeah, so I think good call, Aaron.
Yeah. She tells her the whole story. She says, okay, one thing about this episode that I will say, whole bunch of stigmatizing language about mental health.
It bugs me.
They do it like it's like they had a thesaurus in front of them.
Yeah.
And they just keep digging down.
No, I'd crazy. Love to...
It's bad shit. It's insane. You're like, okay, yes, I understand exactly where they're coming from, but, you know, not the most sensitive to mental health, certainly not.
I would love to talk about the scene where they set Sarah's mom's blood on fire.
Okay, so the first thing they do is they talk about, what was that doctor's name?
Ignaz Hemelvoss or something.
And you had told me that story before.
I'm pretty sure I probably heard it here. Yeah. Right?
And the midwives, but boils down to one of the practices was washing their hands, and one of them thought that would be a stupid thing to do, to waste your time doing. But once he realized that, he was too far ahead of his time for it to be recognized, because germ theory was still decades away.
Germ theory is, like, remarkably new. It's like,
didn't we
scary.
Say something like the 1920s?
We looked it up. Yeah, the window of when it was gaining acceptance, the more recent end of it was the 1920s, which is just...
It's so hard to believe. Yeah, so she basically uses that story to say sometimes people's ideas are looked at as outlandish before people catch on to what's really happening, right?
Yep. Again, this is her using a monologue to elucidate one simple point, which
is,
Aaron, that story is wild, and yet I believe you, and here's why. Like, that's what she's trying to say.
Literally, exactly that. And she's like, have you ever heard of this person? Of course I haven't. Let me tell you.
No. I'm a teacher. Why would I know that story?
And it's like, well, it's not super relevant, but I'm bringing it back to one poignant point that will be.
And the point is kind of like, I don't want to be sent to, I don't want to be looked at as crazy by my colleagues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think she was trying to basically say, I'm starting to have some ideas about what's going on too that I can't make sense of. And so, obviously, we can't just go telling this to anybody because they'll think that there's something wrong with us, but...
This is for you and me. I love that in stories where, like, two people kind of reach the same conclusion around the same time, and then they have, like, each other to confide in. It's kind of a fun, like, narrative device. It's you and me, baby.
Yeah, and like, henceforth, they're really in the same boat together, right?
Oh, yeah, they're a team. And this is fun. When she and Mildred and Sarah are a team, it's fun.
And so Sarah walks her into her examination room, and she does show her that she says she's had all these blood samples that she's supposed to have sent, but she can't stop doing this experiment.
Instead, she just keeps setting them on fire. So she's taking her mother's blood in a petri dish and putting it on her windowsill and edging it into the sunlight and watching it ignite is what she has been doing. And so as she's demonstrating this to Aaron, this is what I don't like, where she says that this is, what'd she say? hold the phone, yes. padded room, clozapine, insane.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm unnecessary. Like, oof. Yeah, especially like as a physician to use those terms, knowing that psych is such a stigmatized area of medicine because yeah. it really is.
Yeah, it is.
Even within hospitals, it is.
I know, yeah.
Between different practitioners who would think that they don't if you ask them. They say, oh, of course, mental health is important, this and that. But the stigma absolutely exists and we feel it every day in my unit. Mm-hmm. And so to hear her say, particularly padded room and yeah. clozapine.
Yeah.
So clozapine is an antipsychotic.
Right.
So,
right.
I don't know. That's especially pigeonholing people with psychotic illnesses as crazy.
Girl, you got to change your crazy ways. And your girl, yeah, you drive me crazy, crazy, crazy. Oh, you blame me.
Well, and it's like stigmatizing to the point that she needed specific medical knowledge to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So it hits my ear, like in the work that I do, that I'm like, ew.
Be like, that person is old. They are fall down, break your hip, shit your pants old. And you're like, hey, easy on the old
exactly.
people.
Exactly. It's like, why would you do why would you
know what
that?
I mean? I'm like, well, yeah, okay, we get it. And I might not always notice that kind of thing, but they were really hitting it over the head.
They were.
Even before Sarah does, like, Aaron's like, it's crazy. It's crazy. Insane.
And see, I don't even mind those as much because those are in
crazy
the common
is
vernacular.
Definitely, I know, but still, you know, like, it's one of those things that I try to be careful about when I speak. And I do still say it by accident. But you could picture as a person who is struggling with mental health, and you know this, you're hearing that and you're like, okay, so it's like people look at this as a very
bad thing.
It's so many words that are used improperly as part of everyday speech, which can send someone the wrong message, right? So we cut to the inside of Paul's house now, and he's taking a bollocking from Bev for not having the curtains closed. And he can already sense that Riley's gone.
I think that's what we were observing when he was on the porch and that his solemn expression there.
Yeah, there was like a soul connection that he didn't feel anymore.
His soul sister
died. Bev is also nervous that basically Riley spilled the beans. She says,
who else was he talking to all night?
Yeah, who did he tell about our plan that everyone's going to be happy about in the end? You know what I mean? Like, they're so sneaky. And
you're obviously
says,
plotting. You don't plot. This is, we're plotting a surprise party. You know what I mean? Like, it's obviously a bad thing.
This episode kicked it so far in that direction that I'm like, they're being more duplicitous than I even gave them credit for, because I almost thought that Paul had lost sight of it so much. But there's some points that I'll mention later that I thought made it clear. Like, he kind of knows more than I gave him credit for, that what he's doing is terrible and bad. But she says, we need to be as wise as serpents. And we need to be as innocent as doves. And they're perfectly the opposite, right? Yeah. They're very short-sighted. They're not acting very wise. And they're certainly as innocent as a snake at this point. Like, they're so sneaky. She likens Riley to Judas while likening herself to the apostles. It's like...
to the other apostles, because he was one too,
true,
guys.
True, true that. But the bad
Judas
one.
Was an apostle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She's just the worst. Every minute she spends on screen, she's so nasty.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut back to Sarah again. It's kind of flashy back and forth between these two scenes. She's speculating about a rare blood disorder that causes significant light and sun sensitivity. And she's like, could this be part of the same family in the same way that the bubonic plague is within the same family as the common cold or something like that? It was interesting. I think I could have done without this.
I probably could have done without it too, and yet it didn't bug me like some medical
mumbo
jumbo.
No, I wouldn't say that either. That's true.
Some medical mumbo jumbo in movies and shows can bug me, but I didn't think this was that bad. And part of the reason is that she's couching her language like that by saying, like, no, it's not the same. This is not porphyria or whatever she had described it
right.
as. She's like, no, it's not that. And no, I don't know about it because it's this new thing. So yeah. I don't know. I didn't mind it, but yeah, I was like, probably a bit more than we needed because it's like, it's all vampires, baby.
Yeah, and we know what's up, right? Yeah. And it was interesting, like, that's where her mind goes, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like we say, you know, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. She's a doctor, so she doesn't think, oh, supernatural.
Yeah, yeah, very true. And same as Riley versus Paul. Like, there was a lot of that going on in the earlier episodes, too. Sarah is wondering if you're at a lower level of the virus as they are, if your body could kind of filter it out like it would alcohol or any other poisonous matter of any kind. That's an interesting thought. So if they were able to escape, is that what would happen? And that's kind of cool.
It is interesting, though, because if we want to look at it as a virus, you don't filter that out, right? Like, what if, like, HIV?
Oh, certain viruses. You know,
they, like, certain ones. So, right. Like, HIV, HPV, herpes.
Yeah.
You just have it forever.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah, that's for
sure.
Your
body doesn't just filter it out eventually.
No, no. So many cases that that's not what happens.
So they're looking at it, I guess, somewhat more like a toxin, I guess.
Yes, and that is kind of basically what they go and eventually say to Hassan. So I suppose that is how they're looking at it. It's funny because Mildred's sitting at the table with them. Right?
Yeah.
She looks like she's almost 30.
Yeah, she looks 30. Sure.
Like, she looks so young. I meant, like, she looks south of 30, not north.
Oh, like she's nearly 30. Yeah, like my 30th birthday is
she's
soon.
Approaching 30. Yeah. She just happens to have gray hair, but it almost looks like purpley in certain scenes in this episode, too. Ed goes to visit Paul to get some guidance. And when he gets there, Bev is like, oh, Ed, good morning to you. In Bev way.
Oh, I hate it.
Trying to be
It's so affected.
Yeah.
Good morning to you.
Yeah,
top
exactly.
Of the morning to you, Ed.
St. Peter's, Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And he walks in and he's, you know, Ed, you know, looking down, shuffling, nervous.
And sees that Dolly is crying.
Know, didn't want to bother anybody, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, all the apostles are there.
Yeah, his apostles, yeah.
So
Wade,
all the apostles.
Dolly, Bev, and Sturge.
Yeah, exactly. And they're there, and he's saying, you know, he was hoping to speak to Father Paul in private. They all just leave to make that happen, right? And he brings the letter forward to Father Paul.
And I think that he was going to ask him to walk out with him.
He
and
did.
And so then they all left.
Yeah, he
yeah,
did.
Instead, yeah.
And Father Paul, like, froze.
Because
it is daytime. And he says, you know, I want you to go over these letters with me. I don't think that Riley's well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And so this is where we think that he, having read them, he thinks that he's delusional. And further to Ed's reason for thinking that, he says there's one for Father Pruitt, or for Monsignor Pruitt. So he's like, well, you know, he's not around. So that seems to lend further credence to the idea that Riley is maybe not in the right state of mind.
And you know what the gross thing is, too, is that, and it's understandable why he does, but Father Paul just leans into that, knowing it's not true.
Yes, he wasn't well. I know, I think it's gross.
So he's saying to Ed, you know, you're right, he's not well, he's not in a good place. This is the poisoning that Bev was talking about. So she's saying, like, Riley's out there poisoning people against us and things like that, and meanwhile, Paul's doing it by
dragging
lying
Riley's name through the mud, implying
exactly,
that
throwing so much mud on Riley,
implying he might be out there on a bender when you know that he was sober until the day he died. You know, isn't that sad?
You know, he's probably, and he said it like in such a flippant way to Ed too. He's probably just out on a bender, like, you
horrible.
Know, Riley.
Exactly. And
you
it's
know
like,
what I mean?
No, Riley has been, you know, nothing but steadfast in his sobriety journey. And it's like so sad.
So Paul just basically tells...
And to his dad.
Yeah. So Paul basically tells a grieving father...
Yeah,
your
you're right.
Your son is mentally ill and probably drunk. It's like, fuck you, Paul.
Yeah, fuck you, Paul, for sure.
You suck.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we know that, Riley's being a hero and he's slandering him.
I know. And just for his own gain, like, it just sucked to watch that, even though obviously he's going to. It's his gambit. He's trying to keep everything secret. But... in such a sick, gross way.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed's hopeful to kind of make the right steps to try to help Riley, to get him some help, that sort of thing. So for that reason, he didn't want to reach out to the law. He didn't think that Riley would appreciate it. He didn't think it would go well.
You know what? That is a problem that we run up against really often in my field, because we'll have people admitted to hospital against their will. You know, that there are times that needs to happen. And usually who's the one who brought it to anyone's attention? Loved ones, right? That's who's going to notice the problem.
Of course.
Family, spouses, good friends.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of conflict sometimes of saying like, oh, you know, don't tell them. They want to give us information, for example, and say like, oh, this person said this to me, which was concerning, but don't tell them I told you.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing. So it's kind of a little dance that you have to do, and you understand where it came from.
Very, very difficult choice to make. And I think Ed is looking for some guidance, basically.
And
right?
Did you notice what he said too?
Oh, well, I wanted to talk to you about this for sure. He said, you know, I did my best with that kid. You know, never could do it with him. Like, we spoke different languages. And I wanted to talk to you about that. Are we going to give Ed, like, did he do his best? Maybe he did his best.
So
I think he could have improved the way that he was responding to Riley significantly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I like the mirroring of I did my best
and I did
my best. Yeah. I like that. But I like it from, I don't know, language of film perspective.
That is cool.
I like that. But I agree. Because you're an adult. You're in control of your behavior. You could have done better because you could have been gentler and kinder. But then maybe he's
I think the question is, did he know better? Is he capable of better?
I was about to say maybe he's from... from a generation of people who didn't think it would be helpful to their child to be gentler and kinder and sweeter, right?
Yep.
Because there are people who don't think that that is the right thing to do and think that it's better, that tough love is better. And it's like, I don't know, that's just a sad state of affairs.
I know. You just feel like Riley didn't get everything he could from Ed, but maybe it's because of Ed's lack of something rather than his lack of willingness to give it, right?
Yes. Maybe a lack of something else.
He's lacking skill big time.
And we've talked about this kind of thing before, but it's like, you know, when did that stop for Riley? When did Riley stop being like a little kid that Ed could relate to because all little kids love to be, you know, picked up and thrown around? And when did he start to be a kid that he didn't understand? When did that disconnect happen?
It's like a dad who can say, like, I love you to a kid until he's like 5 years old.
Oh,
you know what
so
I mean?
Sad.
And then it's only his daughters or something like that.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying?
Horrible. I know what you're saying. And what a horrible thing.
You know, it's just some guys are really terrible at communicating or they feel uncomfortable. And I think that's Ed for sure.
Yeah.
So Paul, he opens the letter that was to Monsignor Pruitt that Ed had basically said, hey, like, can you take this to him? If you can't get it to him, it's okay.
And he says, okay, it's arrived.
Yeah, faster than you think it. And he opens it up and it said, remember, we are dust and to dust we shall return.
Mm.
And he crumples it up angrily, I thought.
Yeah.
He's like, not going to happen.
Yeah.
But did you think that was like a... yeah, you're going to fucking die. This isn't going to work. Did you think it was a threat? Like, how do you read that, him writing that to Father Paul?
I don't think it's a threat from beyond the grave, but I guess I think it's a little bit of like, maybe it's a reminder. We're not supposed to live forever.
I agree. I think he's almost saying, hey, remember, this is what the Bible that you like so much says.
Like
this
wake
is the
up.
Way it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We're not supposed to live forever. Wake up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Erin also goes to the Flynn's house and she speaks with Annie. She's trying to get all of the family to leave the island with her.
I hate this part. What do you think?
What
of
did
it?
She say she's got to do? So, she needs so to have something worked on.
So it's so weird. Erin definitely could have done this way better because
she should have thought it through more.
She's super awkward and she says, hey, Annie, I wonder if you and Ed and Warren would come to the mainland with me on the Belle. And Annie goes, why would we do that? We've got the Easter Vigil tonight. But this whole interaction is weird and not the way people speak. Because then Annie says, I wonder if you would help me and tell me where Riley is because it's been days now. And then you guys come over for dinner and then we all go to the vigil. And then in like a panic, Erin goes, Riley's dead.
Yeah.
And then...
Annie goes cold.
Annie goes so cold and like... this is, I don't like, it makes it seem like, so Annie has seemed through this whole show like she's genuinely really sweet and kind and nice. And this makes it feel like it's fake because she turns on Erin so fast and she says, you know, we've always tried to do right by you and we have done right by you. And why would you say that? That's not funny. And she pushes her off her porch.
It was intense.
Like, the intensity I'm okay with, but like the delivery I don't like and I don't really get it. It's like you may think that what you want about Erin, but you know she and Riley are genuine good friends.
Yeah.
Why would she wouldn't play a trick on you and say that he's dead?
Not to mention, I think what this does execute well, which is something that they've been seeding throughout the show, is that mom's kind of base level when things aren't going well is denial. So imagine your son's missing.
And has been
haven't
for days.
Seen him in days. I don't know if she knows about the letters, but Ed did. Like, maybe he stole hers.
I didn't know that either, because she does seem to be unaware.
Okay, so your son's missing. It's unlike him.
Mm-hmm.
You're very scared. Someone tells you he's dead.
The
and
woman
you're like,
that you
fuck
thought,
you.
Yeah, the woman you thought he was with.
Yeah.
Says he's dead.
She doesn't interrogate it one bit. She just goes into denial. How could you say that? That's so mean.
Yeah, she says that's not funny. You're right. Not funny.
Oh my
funny.
God. As if she would try to do that to be
like,
funny.
She's like, I got you.
Yeah, got you, Annie. Your son's not dead, you dumb bitch. Yeah.
And Riley's in the bushes like, I did not like that interaction.
Oh, it hurt. It wasn't fun to watch. And you're right, too. Aaron should have done a way better job.
Aaron was super weird.
Annie, you know what? Riley's on the mainland and he needs your help. Let's go.
Yeah, or even say something like, even if you wanted to tell her Riley's dead, say like, Riley got caught up in something horrible that's going on this island. It is to do with the new guy from out of town.
He's going to kill Warren.
He's going to kill, he says he's going to kill us. Riley was super concerned and Riley died. We need to go. We need to get out of here. You know what I mean? But then we wouldn't have a rest of the story.
Yeah, true. For narrative reasons, she's like, come to the mainland with me and we'll, I can't even remember what her stupid reason was.
I don't even think she said. She said, I want you to come to the mainland with me on the bell. You, Warren, and Ed. It's like, why the hell?
A group of four that's never hung out.
Exactly.
And one thing that Annie did say before she goes kind of scorched earth, is like, we're not missing that vigil.
Yeah.
Tonight's Easter.
Well, yeah, right? But that's like, that is another thing that makes it like, why would you ask me, a very religious person who attend to
it's
not go to
kind of the Super Bowl this weekend, lady.
It is.
I've spoken to some of my Catholic colleagues about that.
Mm-hmm.
Is Christmas the Super Bowl or is Easter the
Easter
Super Bowl?
Easter is.
But Christmas is so important because that's when he was born.
It's so important, but it's important for it's secular reasons that make it so big.
Well, certainly, yeah.
It's because it's such a big holiday for everyone, even people who aren't religious. That's what makes it seem big. But in the actual church, no, Easter's the Super Bowl, baby. Okay, that's so when the miracle happened. Yeah, he was born.
Well,
he was born of a
immaculate mother.
Yeah, but every baby's born, he came back to life.
That's true.
That's the big miracle.
Yeah, you got a point there.
Yep.
So yeah, that I agree. I didn't like watching that scene, but it had to happen. And we cut to another scene setting up another monologue. And I know you and I both have problems with this one a little bit.
Yeah.
Where Sarah is there to speak to Hassan to say there's a contagion being spread at St. Patrick's.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Hassan's being uncharacteristically prickly with her, too.
Yeah, yes, he is being quite surly.
Like, he's never like that to anyone.
And
I know that's his thing, and maybe he gets tired of keeping that up.
And why with Sarah? But like, it's like, why with Sarah? She is like the gay doctor.
They're like-minded.
Well, and it's like, you guys are both on the outs a little bit. Like, in terms of this Catholic-dominated community, she is like an atheist who doesn't attend church who is also gay, and you're an out-of-towner who is Muslim. It's like, you guys should be best friends.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're both outsiders within this community, so they should be able to team up in a way and relate to each other on that level.
Yes.
And yet they're both, I think, intellectuals.
I think they're both on the same wavelength in terms of how they think.
Yeah.
I agree.
And yet, so Sarah comes in, she says what her concern is. She says, I'm gonna go talk to my
underplays it, right?
She does, because she doesn't want to seem outlandish.
Yes.
And so she says, I'm going to talk to my colleagues on the mainland, but in the meantime, can you look into it? So I'm going to do my end as a doctor. I'd like you to do your end as the long arm of the law, basically. And then he, goes on a tangent that'll end with all this to say, basically. it's one of those things where he says a Mike Flanagan trademark monologue to say one thing.
Yes.
Not that it's not a good monologue, but you and I discussed that maybe it had a good place in an earlier episode and to a different audience, because I feel that it's quite confrontational and I don't feel like I don't feel like Sarah deserves that.
No, I felt the same.
And he talks about how he has why he moved to the island with Ali. He says, oh, it's almost like no one ever asked. Like, he feels like he wasn't embraced by this community, which,
fair enough. He's got a good gripe there.
Sure, but not with Sarah.
Yeah.
And that's the audience. And so.
Yeah, you're right. And I agree with you 100%. It's a good monologue. It's a good story.
It is a good story.
For anyone who isn't going to watch or hasn't, he tells the story of becoming a police officer in New York after 9/11. And how, you know, that led to him being surveilled even though he was a police officer, and all this mistreatment because of his race, because of his ethnicity, his culture, his religion.
I thought we were supposed to be fighting terrorists. Not flipping some pothead student in Queens to spy on Americans. So, I complain. Gently. One time. Everything changed. I was surveilled. By other cops. I mean, they even had an official file on me.
It was a good monologue, but...
It was, yeah.
The audience, us, is on board with the fact that everything's out there. People know that there's something really bad going on, and we know it's a vampire, and everyone's about to die. Sarah knows it's this contagion and all this stuff. It took away from the urgency. Mm-hmm. For him to go back and to do this. It wasn't the right time. And that's why I think it didn't ring well with me.
No, and it just doesn't seem, it seems like they're butting heads over something that they agree on. And it just bugged me. It just bothered me.
Yeah.
And like perfectly good monologue, wrong place.
Agreed. We should have just learned it earlier and it could have been good world building.
Yeah.
To help us better understand Hassan. Yeah, like maybe, but it was too late.
Maybe like a walk home from that meeting that they had with Bev in the
100%,
schoolhouse.
100%. It would be perfect,
you know?
Timing.
It would be great. Maybe he's talking to, do you know what would have been good? Joe's in the cell. He's talking to Joe.
That would have been great.
That would have been good.
I think Joe would have been happy to hear it. And he would have had a very heartfelt understanding. Because Joe, despite all his flaws, I think was an empathetic guy.
I think so too. And I think he would have had kind of like a simple... straightforward response of being like, yep, I know what that's like, you know, being on the outs. I think that he would have been able to like relate in a simple, straightforward way without hangups. I don't know. So that would, you know, that would have been good. Mike Flanagan, talk to us about your next original horror piece and we'll help you out.
Yeah, please. We'll be reasonable with our demands.
10%.
Yeah, exactly.
Each
per head has to be.
Yeah, your head and my head.
And
Mike
also,
Flanagan's head gets 80%.
One funny thing that he says as he's kind of really getting more escalated, he's like, and I don't do this, and I keep my head down, and blah, 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 and yeah. I don't overshare. I was like, you do overshare, buddy. You're doing it right now, just so you know.
Yeah, like in general.
I love Hassan.
Me too.
But then he was like, in the Dragon's Den. It was like, and for those reasons, I'm out.
Exactly.
Of investigating St. Patrick's.
And then this, like, okay, so then when he says, and I don't carry a gun. She says, you don't carry a gun?
Yeah.
And then he says, no need. And she just kind of says, So what do you think about this considering what we see later?
I think that he was reconsidering after she left and he was kind of getting the pins and needles and he decided to renege on that.
Yes, and this is the other thing that's annoying. So he gave her this long monologue to say, bah, 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 like, maybe I don't want to do that. And then but he's going to do it. So why, you just had to make her suffer first is what it felt like.
I'll do it, but I'm not happy about it.
Well, exactly.
You know what he also does just before she leaves? Because this is what this episode is about, and we can't miss an opportunity. He disparages Riley. Because that's what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
He's dead. And everyone's like, well, he was a junkie. He was an addict. That's Riley.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like everyone has to do it, apparently. And it's just like Bull, right? It's the stigma. It's just like Joe with the addiction. And even though Riley was from a different background, certainly, than Bull and then Joe, and if it hadn't been for the addictions, they would have looked at him as
a pillar of the community like Annie and Ed are.
Very likely. And it just goes to show the amount to which someone's lifestyle, their transience, the things that they're struggling with, including mental health, including addictions, can play into people's opinions, but how that can have real world repercussions too, where, you know, people aren't wanting to follow up with Riley in the right ways because he was an addict. Mm-hmm. And so they just assume that that's what he's off doing. But just like, did Hassan have to do that? Like, geez.
Yeah, and it's like, you've known Riley for like 2 weeks. He hasn't even been home that long.
That's true.
For 4 weeks, the duration of Lent.
the group of dissenters, which is Aaron and Sarah and Mildred, are stood waiting for the ferry.
Yeah, this is where it's like a girl gang. It's fun.
Yeah, and and Sturge emerges from a fishing boat, and he says, oh, you know, neither of the fairies are coming. They're both out for repairs.
And they're like, both of them?
Exactly. Okay. They're like beyond suspicious. They know something's up.
And then they're like, okay, why are you on that boat doing repairs? And he's got like a hunk of engine in his hand. Like, what kind of repair are you doing?
An enginectomy, I think. And Sarah basically asks him if he services all the fishing boats on the island. And he says, yeah, I reckon I do. Pretty much all of them.
And she says, well, what if I want to bring something to the mainland? A fisherman could bring me over. And he's like, why would you want to do that? It's Easter.
Don't you
it's
know the vigils tonight?
Yeah. So they're getting, you know, in not so many words, getting the impression that you can't leave.
Yeah, and it'll get even worse as it goes, right? And they kind of trot off. They kind of go to a bit of a run as they leave Sturge. And Mildred looks like a badass. She's got like
she's got this a little, like headscarf on
and some big shades. She looks like something out of like Thelma and Louise or something.
She looks so cute.
Doing their little investigations, Scooby gang around town. And as we continue, we get more scenes as kind of it draws closer to night. Wade and Sturge are sabotaging boats, cutting power, disarming radio towers, and talking about evading the sheriff. So how can they feel that they're doing the right thing?
And they seem so full on. Well, more,
it's like espionage.
More Wade than Sturge, but they seem like full on evil. Like Wade gives me big evil vibes when he says, like, well, the sheriff's eyebrow's already up. Let's leave the cell tower for now. It's like, yeah, honestly, that's the way it feels.
Yeah, it's like it's made this jump from, well, you know, everyone will understand and we're doing the right thing and all this stuff to now they have to do it and they have to deceive everyone,
to themselves,
trap everyone, make sure they can't speak to anyone else. They have to keep the sheriff out of it. Like, that's pretty intense. You know what else I wondered? Why is Mildred not mentioning the fact that she knows that Father Paul is Monsignor Pruitt?
I don't know.
Like, we know she knows.
Yeah.
He said, I have so much to tell you. It was this big moment.
Yeah, that's right? True.
She's not, like, saying anything about it.
Do you think she doesn't want to tell Sarah because she thinks that it'll come up that he's her real dad? Like, you know, why would he confide that in you? Maybe something along those lines?
Could be. Yeah, maybe there's something. But I just thought at this point, when you're starting to suspect everyone.
Yeah, why wouldn't you be like, hey, yeah, here's another, you know, point of
intrigue
here.
Right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, she also knows that she's, like, de-aged. She has to
know that. Oh, she knows that, yeah.
She's not thinking she just had, like, a good rebound. Like,
no, she knows that.
Yeah. Interesting, eh? So Aaron, they're sat at the table. They're trying to decide what to do. How can we get off? How can we hide? How can we escape? And Aaron basically says, thanks for all your help, but I'm going. And I was like, oh, she's leaving tonight. She's leaving in a rowboat. But no, she meant I'm going to Mass.
I'm going to Mass.
Right.
So this is another place where I'm like, Kate, people don't talk this way. And I know that sometimes things are heightened.
For dramatic
but
effect.
Like when she says, because Mildred says, but why would you go? And she says, because I don't know anything. I'm like, that's weird. Why would you say it like that? And she says, I know that Riley thought that it was a big deal and he's got people there that he loves and this and that. So like, it comes back around, but I hated that initial response. I'm nitpicking, obviously.
Yes, but you know that I hate the trope where you kind of drop some vague thing and people are like, what does that mean? And then you're like, here's what it means.
Yeah,
and
you exactly. Why would you go to Mass? Because I don't know anything. Okay.
What do you mean, Aaron?
Yeah, please go on, Aaron.
We'd like to know.
We'd love another monologue.
Oh, my God. And she says also she's going because Riley sacrificed everything so that she could help people. I'm not so sure that's what he did.
He sacrificed everything.
I want you to survive.
I want you to get away.
I want you to run. She took it in that he's enabling me to save other people.
Yeah.
But really, he was working hard to make sure that she was safe.
And he said that to her. He said, I know you're going to try to help people.
True, true.
But I guess we could look at it that he was resigned to knowing the kind of person that she is and say, like, I would love it if you just got yourself away because I love you. But I know you're the kind of person who's going to help. And this information is going to help you either way, whichever direction you want to go.
Fair enough. Not to mention he told other people. He told his parents. He knew they wouldn't listen.
He did. Right? He told his parents. Oh, that's so sad. He told his parents, the other people closest to him, but she's the only one who heard it. I mean, she obviously saw the evidence too. That helps.
True. So we get a scene as well at the Hassan's residence where he's praying.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, Ali, I miss you praying with me. It would mean a lot to me if you'd come pray with me. And he's not going to. He doesn't. And then Ali kind of turns it back on him and he says, well, tonight's Easter.
Instantly.
It's midnight vigil. It would mean a lot to me if you came with me. And Father Paul's promising a miracle tonight and basically is saying everything's going to change tonight.
And I mean, Hassan probably had more than one reason. Well, we know he had more than one reason to go with Ali to the church. But here's a good example of something that Ed could have benefited from is being the bigger person. You know, because here Ali says, no, I'm not going to pray with you, but could you do this for me? And Hassan's the dad. He says, yeah, okay.
It's like if your kid was into video games and you don't know the first thing about them, but you could try to learn about them. If it meant, you know, spending some time with your son, your daughter, maybe it would be worth it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But you might have to do something that you're not comfortable with or not the expert on in order to make it happen sometimes, especially when kids are of certain ages and it's harder to connect with them.
Like Ali, like a teenager.
Exactly. Literally just like that.
And
yes.
He's a single dad.
Yeah.
Just doing his best.
Not doing no harm.
You know, he's a single dad who works one job.
Yeah, who loves his kid.
Never stops.
Gentle hands. He doesn't have to work very hard.
Gentle hands with the heart of a
That applies to Hassan in every way for sure. No problem.
A single dad who works one job.
Just better to say like has a job. You say works one, it like diminishes it.
A single dad who has a job.
It's like if you say. It's like you're saying, well, he's got a job. How many? Well, one.
Yeah.
But he works it.
Oh, yeah. He works it all the time. He is the only one.
Thank you, Reba. The miracle line, I thought, gets Hassan's hackles up. He's like, what is this preacher talking about?
Well, exactly. Like, if you heard that someone was promising,
could you imagine?
If you heard that someone in our community said, come to my church because there will be a miracle, I'd be like, well, how... I would think how immoral of that man to do.
I think in this case, maybe like not if I was in Hassan's position, but if I were giving things the benefit of the doubt, I'd be like, oh, he's going to tell you about Easter. Oh. Like this is the day that he moved the rock and he came out of the tomb.
A miracle.
This miracle.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I know that one.
Bev meets with the mayor and his family, the Scarboroughs, for some caroling through the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Easter this caroling was such a cool scene.
Very cool.
Oh my God, it was awesome.
Cool image, kind of haunting.
Well, okay.
Takes you through the town. It's great.
This is a note that I have too. So it's dark, it's nighttime. Mm-hmm. This show is masterful at flipping things that should be innocent or even encouraging, joyful, and showing how sinister they could look from another angle, right? So people are caroling, they're collecting people as they go, and they're lighting candles, and there's a huge group eventually. Mm-hmm. We get a beautiful shot that's from a bird's eye view that just shows all the lit candles walking down this dark road. It's so effective. Mm-hmm. It's so scary.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're doing is singing like a joyful hymn and walking together, right? So it's I just thought it was so interesting, and it really, I found it very effective.
And like you say, flipping things on their head. Another thing about this is that it's making springtime so spooky, you know?
Certainly.
Making springtime feel like Halloween.
Yeah, you're right. They keep walking. Aaron and Sarah and Mildred join the train.
Up. Yeah.
Right? Did you think that Bev was seething to see Aaron join the train? I thought she flashed her a look that was like,
She did give her a look. I didn't know if it was seething or just like wary.
And why the hell are Sarah and Mildred going?
I think
Mildred literally said we're never going back there because she heard him speak in that way.
I think she's just going in. I think they're both going in solidarity with Aaron.
To help Aaron?
Yeah.
They shouldn't have.
Well, yeah.
And the last thing, as you mentioned, that they like sabotage is the cell tower. So Sturge does that.
Why didn't they already call a cell phone earlier? Why didn't they all say, bring some boats?
Oh, you know, why didn't that group?
Before they did that. Yeah, why didn't they?
100%. they were trying to handle it themselves.
Yeah, like, why didn't they say, like, send some fucking boats? There's,
no kidding.
Yeah. I hate finding plot holes in great, because this is a wonderful show.
It's a great show.
We love this story. I think it's generally really well written. I hate finding plot holes like that, but it's like, we know for a damn fact that the cell towers were up and running after they were already suspicious.
Yep.
So it's like, why wouldn't they have called?
That's a great question that I hadn't thought
I probably
about.
Would have said, like, our fairies aren't able to come, and it, like, I would have said,
yeah, we
need
help.
I would have been Sarah and said, like, you know, I'm a doctor, we got some people here who need help.
I would have said, I've got someone who's having a medical emergency.
Yeah,
she's 90 but she looks 30, just so don't be surprised
that's,
when you get
that's
here.
That's the medical emergency.
Yeah, exactly.
She's got young-itis.
She's got Benjamin-ingus butinitis.
Yeah,
the worst case we've ever seen.
Yeah,
you know what, too, and another thing, I'm not searching for plot holes either.
Mm.
On an island like that, there would be generators all over the place.
Yeah, they would have been like, no problem.
They're
flip
like,
it on.
They get terrible weather.
Yeah.
They're an island on the ocean, and they would for sure have houses all over the place with generators.
And why would the cutting the power, why even do that? Who cares if they've got power or not? Wouldn't the cell towers be the only thing that matters?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the power's not going to get you off the island.
No.
One thing, maybe this is it, maybe it isn't. They did talk about that when things happen like that, they're meant to go to the church.
That's true. It would bring people to
maybe
the church.
Maybe it would bring people who wouldn't have gone.
That's true.
The church is packed on that note. Packed to the rafters. It's a full house.
Mm-hmm.
Got beautiful candles everywhere, too.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
The lighting is so pretty.
It's
that,
gorgeous,
like, nice
in there.
Orange, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is another thing, and I've mentioned it before along the way in this series. The voices of the choir and the organ. It was like itching a part of my brain.
Oh, yeah.
Because
scratching and itching
like
a part of your brain.
I've been there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I have sat in a room and heard this exact thing happen around me. And it was just, it sounded exactly like I would expect. And it was just something like that, that there was an authenticity to it. Even the way the voices stop and then the organ stops and everything. Like, it's a very nitpicky, but in a good way, thing that I was like, wow, that was... almost like transported me, which is a douchey thing to say,
it
but
just,
that's the way it felt.
But it just like rings very true.
He's wearing his gold chasuble again.
Yep, and comments on that.
He does, and he says, hey, you know, funny story. When I first got here, Bev called me out on it. She said, why are you wearing it in ordinary time? And it's because Paul recognized that his return was not an ordinary time because he's a pretentious dickhead. He's like, this is a holy day.
Yeah, because I'm back, baby.
Yeah, but what? Like, Father Paul's got his groove back.
He says, I have risen. Yeah. Yeah, how Paul got his groove back.
Because he's a pompous asshole, and he's like, I'm wearing this because today's a holy day.
He believes his own hype big time.
Dumbass. He does acknowledge that he's been sinning and lying to them. So one of the things that we've been calling him out for is the fact that he doesn't seem to have any perspective
to apologize for the right things. Like,
but he still doesn't.
The lying is not the problem. Yeah.
He talks about the lie he's been telling them about their priest, right? Who some of you have noticed, some of you haven't. He stands before you now, right? Not apologizing or having any introspection about the more problematic behaviors, but he does acknowledge his own lie.
Mm-hmm.
He says that he was restored by the angel in Damascus. He brought that angel with me. Doesn't mention, like, yeah, I boxed him up in an old trunk and I dragged him here. Doesn't sound very angelic.
Yeah.
Ed and Annie look disturbed and confused.
Yes,
did you agree with that?
Yep, absolutely.
And he says as well, he's laying the groundwork. He's saying, we will be tested tonight, just a little bit. It's like, don't worry.
Just,
it's just
a step off the boat onto the water.
Yes. And I thought, and again, can't praise the delivery and the performance by Hamish Linklater enough.
Amazing. It's like this. I imagine that being an actor and being told you get to play a priest in this, this is the kind of scene that you would want, where he's got the chasuble on, he's running around, he's
100%.
Gesturing to the heavens, he's yelling, he's using,
chew some
you know,
scenery.
Like, oh, it would be so fun. Can you imagine doing that performance? It would be so fun.
Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life.
I know. I think I'd probably go a little too Southern super pastor on it.
Yeah. He's great. He's great. Great. He's wonderful. Great.
He's conveying a very well-rehearsed sermon, in my opinion.
That's great. It's a performance.
I agree. And it had its like sing-song element that sermons can. Kind of a rat-a-tat, but like in a like iambic pentameter almost kind of way. But he's also really conveying a lot of nervousness. So he's like trying to be reassuring, trying to make sure that people get to the other side of this big event that's going to happen. And I think
stay with me, basically.
Exactly. He's showing his nervousness. And I think that shows he knows that he's kind of doing something that he shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
Right. He has to be persuasive. He has to make sure that they stay along with him. So I thought that that was really well done. He also says, don't worry, we'll be showing you proof, which again, is exactly what Hassan and Riley tried to explain. That's not how it's supposed to work.
Yep.
If you know the Bible, then you should know that that wouldn't be part of it, right? Which is just, it's really good that that's coming back again.
And Hassan is there with Ali.
Oh, pardon me. Yes. Hassan did go with Ali and he's sitting in the bleachers with him.
All of our favorites are there in the pews.
All in the pews or the bleachers.
Yeah, they're like raised up.
Yeah, bunch of foam fingers and stuff. Father Paul. As well, we get a scene. I mean, it's a little too bad because it's a real life tragedy, but we get a very Jonestown scene where they pan across all these cups. And at the end of the cups on a table that Bev, in the back room where Bev went, is the poison that she had used to kill Joe's dog.
Do you know how many people died in the Jonestown massacre?
No.
Over 900 people.
Oh my God. I would have thought it was in the tens, not the hundreds.
It was colossal. It was an enormous loss of life. I remember when I heard that, I was like, that sounds like impossible. And it's painted as, you know, the colloquialism, drink the Kool-Aid. It's painted as a mass suicide. In large part, it was a mass murder.
Oh, I didn't realize that there was like violence as well as the poisoning.
People were injected with the poison.
Oh, God. Ugh, that's awful.
Anyway, a little bit about Jonestown.
Yeah, and I just thought it was interesting. So this is the mechanism that they're going to use to kill people so that they can be born again, essentially, as a vampire. And just earlier in this episode, Bev had been using metaphor, accusing Riley of poisoning their flock, and they're literally, serving up
poison their entire flock,
paper cups of poison to their whole flock. Yep. I was like, that was so interesting to me.
Yeah, that's a good catch.
Wow. And they have elected Sturge to die.
Of course they did.
Oh yeah,
Bev Sturge wasn't gonna do it. Oh. Who should it have been? Bev. She was the number one acolyte.
I thought she couldn't wait to become holy, so I'm almost surprised.
Yeah, but she's a coward. Yeah. She wants to make sure it's okay for other people first, because I think she is cowardly.
She's just wicked in every way.
Yep.
You know, she's got no morals that are on display in this show.
She wouldn't be the guinea pig. She wants to see how someone else does it first.
Jesus. And he tells the flock, basically, hey, this will be frightening, but Sturge, my brother in Christ, are you afraid? And it's more of this stupid emotional reasoning that Paul seems to like. I have no guilt. Must not be bad.
Yeah.
Sturge isn't afraid. Must not be bad. Again, Father Paul just ruining everything.
Yeah, like if a toddler isn't afraid of a snake, does it mean that they're like inspired by God? Or does it mean that they don't know what's dangerous about a snake?
Better yet, what if a toddler doesn't feel remorse? Which a toddler never does.
Oh my God. That's my toddler.
Yeah, your son's just in that phase that all kids get to where it's like, no.
Oh mine. My God. And it's such a cliche, but he's saying no all the time
so
now.
It's so funny.
It is funny. And he says it like with a big grin on his face. He's like, no.
Oh, kid's hilarious. So Sturge dies extremely violently and painfully from the poison.
Yep.
It was disgusting. It was disgusting. So terrible. And Paul's terrified that people won't listen. He's begging them to have faith because everyone's like, oh, they do the big crowd gasp.
I know. It sounds silly, right? It's like a soundboard
that happens. Exactly.
It's okay. It's all right. That's all right.
It might as well be
a Wilhelm scream.
Yeah, they might. Ah! We're going to have to put that in.
He says, this is what Easter's about.
Yeah. Is it?
Some Catholics disagree. And Hassan is basically like, fuck this.
Okay, so I love this.
It's a cool scene.
He grabs Ali's hand and he doesn't say a thing to anyone, says, we're getting the hell out of here.
Yeah.
The only thing would have been, he probably would have done it sooner. He probably wouldn't have had to wait for...
Couldn't agree with you more on that one.
...him to die. But I love that he's like...
Maybe he was stunned.
I love that he's not like, hey, stop it. I love that he's like, I'm taking the thing that matters. I'm taking the thing that matters to me and I'm getting the hell out of here. And then, Basie note, in pops the angel in a chasuble of his own.
Blocking the back door.
And this wonderful, great reveal. And I love the acting from everyone in the pews is great to really get across just how creepy and scary this guy looks.
Yeah.
Like Annie and Ed are Annie's clutching onto Ed and they're both kind of recoiling from him.
And Paul's doing his whole song and dance. Lo, the angel appeared and they were afraid. And he's doing a lot of that. And he's like, remember, in the Bible, it always basically says that angels are scary, right? And he's like, that's why this guy looks so fucked up. That's why he's so creepy. And what did you think of the scene when the angel reaches the pulpit?
And spreads his wings? I like it.
Yeah, I thought it was so cool.
Because it goes from you could think, okay, that's just a fucked up looking person, to be like, oh, that's something else. That's something we've never seen before, never heard of before. Like, kinda what uncanny is valley. That? I think... But more so, this is full-on supernatural.
Oh, once the wings come out, you mean? Oh, yes, I agree. It sets it in that new category for everyone. Yep. They're like, holy
shit. I love it. Like, we're at the climax now. All bets are off.
Yes.
Things are turned up to 11. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. I just thought that was so cool. You know what it did make me think was funny, though, by the time we got to that point?
That they had to put slits in the chasuble for his wings?
And that they made him dress up.
Yeah, you put this on. Well, I guess he's naked otherwise.
Like, yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah, but does the angel care? Does the vampire care?
I think the vampire's just along for the ride. It's hilarious. If
he
you
was
think
wearing
about,
like a top hat and a cloak earlier. Yeah.
If you think about anything from his perspective, it's very funny. He's just like, okay.
He's like, this is weird.
He's some ageless being, on another plane of existence, but he's like, okay.
Paul makes him wear the gold chasuble just like him.
We're going to match. It's going to be so cool.
Oh, man. They're going to love it. They're going to eat it up. And the apostles are so happy when Sturge stands. They're like, oh, my God, see, we told you guys. Basically, they're rejoicing about that. And the organist sits down and starts playing again.
So I guess the organist must, either he's just a really faithful guy or he was in on it, too.
Show must go on type of performer.
Yeah.
And Paul's emboldened in his sermon then. There's no more nervousness. He's just like letting it fly. Let your earthly body die to complete the transformation, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's really awesome. The angel is a dead-eye creep.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we both agree about that. And also, when Hassan and Ali go to leave, Ali won't come.
Yeah.
And he kind of runs closer to Paul.
He says, stop.
Yeah. And then Bev is just being so disgusting. She's saying, look, he's so holy. Even when his father implored him to turn his back on faith, he chose God.
You know what?
Wow.
I meant to do a bit of research about cultish language and factors of cults. I know two of them. One of them is charismatic leader. You've got it in Paul. Another one is love bombing, and she's doing it.
Yeah, for sure. That would be a good example of that. She's giving him so much kudos for something by twisting it to make it something that it's not.
Yeah, it was so good that you just didn't heed your dad who's desperately trying to save your life.
And yeah, she's trying to make him think he's trying to make you turn your back on faith. It was terrible. Yeah.
And then Hassan
just pulls out the gun.
Pulls out his gun, which is a bad move. Everyone there is against it. Well, I think the worst move is when he shoots at the...
At the ceiling?
At the ceiling, because then everyone tackles him to the ground.
Everyone tackles him, yeah.
I hate the way Bev then responds by saying, you bring a firearm into the house of God. It's
Are
like,
you kidding
you
me?
jugs full of poison.
And a fucking vampire.
Yeah, into the house of God. So this is so tense.
Yeah.
So hard to watch. It's so horrible. the worst thing you could ever imagine. So Hassan is being pinned to the ground by a bunch of henchmen, basically, all these true believers.
Yeah, yeah.
They've now pinned him to the ground. And Bev, who is an absolute snake in the grass, you're just watching her, like, dance and tempt him into taking this poison. You're like, from Hassan's perspective, it must feel just like an absolute nightmare. And so she's saying, like, oh, you're so faithful, you're so good, you're so holy, here, why don't you show us, here, take this cup of poison. And so Ali takes it, and I hate this for so many reasons, and he says, I choose God. I hate it, because it's also same God. That's the other thing. It's like, you have the same God between those two. He says, I choose God.
Maybe he's come to the place that he thinks that this is the only right way to go to God. You know?
I think he does. I just don't like the line.
But that's a good point. It is the same God, and people might not always recognize that.
So he drinks it. Okay, and now I'm already on my soapbox, but I'm going to stay on it, because this is where...
You go, girl. You deserve it.
Yeah, you go, girl. This is where I feel like the biggest plot hole in the series happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would have been way better if they'd done it differently. Because when I was watching this, I was like, I felt like I was in on something. Yeah, right. I felt like, oh, I know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then it didn't happen and I was really disappointed. So when you are not Catholic, like Ali and Hassan, you can attend. Yeah, like, you can attend services anytime.
Yeah.
That's most churches. You can... and temples, places of worship, you can attend, but you perhaps can't participate in certain rites if you are not a part of the religion. So that's what we're having here. So Ali's perfectly welcome to attend and to take all these services, but he would not have been given communion. He would not have gotten the bread and the wine. And so the whole thing is that all these people are able to take the poison and then be resurrected because they have been taking in the vampire's blood through communion. But no matter, even if Ali had been going every Sunday, which we're thinking he's been going for a while, he is not baptized, not confirmed.
Right.
So he would not have been allowed to have the communion.
Yeah.
So when he took the poison, he should have died for real. He should not have been resurrected. And so that's what, when I thought that I had special knowledge, I thought that that's what was going to happen.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, how much worse? Hassan just literally watched his son just die in front of him and not be resurrected.
Right.
So I was like, oh my God, he's not going to get up. He's going to be really dead. And he just watched his child just really die in front of him. But then he does get up, and I just feel like that's a plot hole and a miss.
I think you're right, because, you know, when you're in a situation like that, you have to go up like an absolute loser with an X of your arms across your chest, and they bless you, but they don't give you the communion.
And we know this for a fact, because we are non-Catholics who have attended a lot of Catholic services.
Quite right, and boy, did made us feel so small.
I have not tasted communion once in my life.
We did eat the church lady sandwiches. Do you think that was allowed afterwards?
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's allowed.
Okay. Whew. Okay, but you're right. It would have been a very intense scene.
How
like
intense
you said,
would that have
if
been?
If he fell dead, everyone else stood up. It wouldn't last long because they're half alive. They're not really alive, but he doesn't get up.
But imagine if Ali just never got up. How impactful would that have been? And this is the other thing, because I said in another episode that that Hassan seems to be the only character in this, the only character of faith who seems to really, Riley's not a character of faith. So he's the only character of faith who seems to really understand what it's about.
Yeah,
so like,
you're right.
Understand that that's not how miracles work, that this and that.
Yeah.
So I thought that wouldn't it have been extra special if he was also the only one who realized the gravity of his son drinking the poison? You know, what if he had said something like, you know, he was a Muslim, he didn't get communion, whatever.
Yeah. Would have brought a few things home.
What if Bev had said, oh, you know, see how afraid you are? You need not be afraid, for he will be resurrected because he's been attending services. What if she had done something like that, super full of herself, like we know that she is, and then he could have said something like, no, he's not. He's Muslim. He didn't take the communion, and really put her in her place, pull the rug out from under her. Imagine how impactful that would have been.
You're right.
Anyway. But love this show, but I felt like that's the one thing that's been in the back of my head this whole time. I was excited to talk about it.
And people, I think you're right, and that takes, you know, that's probably a detail that was kind of nagging at you.
It was. Because I felt like I knew.
Yeah, the inside track on some info, because we've kind of grown up near that, right?
Exactly.
You're right about that. So someone knocks the gun out of Hassan's hand. People are drinking poison and dying everywhere. And mm-hmm. Ali was one of the first, but now people everywhere are doing it. And Mildred scoops up the gun, and with some serious skill, she headshots Father Paul.
But you know what? She misses first.
She shoots twice.
But I love it because she misses, and he knows she's pointing at him. She shoots, misses, and he's looking at her like, "You're trying to shoot me?" And yeah. she's like, "Hell yeah, I am."
Then
and
she does shoot it again. Right in the forehead.
And she loves him. So, like, yeah. what a horrible, like, I think that is text, is that she was meant to really love him. They were right. meant to be, like, at one point lovers and for a long time close, if not best friends.
Right.
And yet she knows that what is right is more important. And so she shoots him, even though she does love him.
And she also doesn't recognize him anymore, which she's mentioned,
yep.
right?
Yep. He's not who she thought he was.
And when that happens, the angel kind of screams, the vampire, and swoops on her like an eagle on a Bichon Frise and just like takes her right out the back door.
An eagle on a Bichon Frise, as they say.
Screams and just goes and grabs her. It was.
And you think he's like, "That's my friend."
Yeah, like, was that it? He's like,
I think he's like, "That's my protector.
Fair enough.
You fucked me over."
Fair enough.
And then Sarah goes, "Mom!" I'd like another like lovely little instance of performance. I think her name is Annalise, that actress.
Oh, okay.
Like a lovely little moment of performance from Sarah too.
Totally.
Like yes. she sounds like a kid. Something about Aww. It to be like, "Mom!" I don't know. Yeah, because she watches her elderly mother get swooped out of the church. On angel's wings.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Sounds nice, actually. I was swept out of the church on angel's wings.
Yeah, and then killed.
Yeah, unceremoniously ravaged by this thing. Bev says, "Oh, he'll be fine." And she says, "How can you spit in the face of such a gift to Hassan?"
Mm-hmm. She hates him because of her racism, and this is just her chance to act like it's justified.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And she's saying to keep the doors locked. To rejoice.
Yeah, she goes, "Lock the doors."
They will awaken and be thirsty for communion. Yeah, for killing people. She's going full deranged preacher, right? And Wade wakes up. He's the first to feed on somebody.
Wade is so scary.
Creepy. And he's got the glowing eyes.
And he's the mayor. And there's something so creepy. He goes to a young woman. And says, "It's okay.
It's okay. It'll be okay. Okay." And then he just bites her.
And grabs her by the hair and rips her off the pew and throws her onto the ground. Like, until the point that he bites her neck, it's just
a
violent human assault beating. That's and it's so disturbing to watch.
It is. And Lisa's watching that.
That's her dad.
Like, people who know these people are now seeing them behave in these ways that they don't horrible, understand. Yeah. Annie, Hassan, Sarah, and Aaron all make it to the back room when all this pandemonium is going on.
Oh, which is so
and Warren. Off.
No, but Ed doesn't. Ed's fighting people off. He says, "Go." And then he says, like, "Annie, go." And they all get through the door except for him. He's trying to, he's leading her out. But then they get to the point that they're at, like, the front.
Gotcha.
And he's fighting them with, like, candlesticks and says, "No, keep going."
And Lisa's so, there, too.
And so here's, and Lisa had to be, Lisa was the hardest one to grab because Dolly had her. And Warren grabbed her in a bear hug. And they had
Warren
to together.
Saved her.
Warren saved her because it's just so heartbreaking, right? It's like, if you want to perceive him as her partner, like, because he's her boyfriend, whatever. And it's just like them versus her parents and like this like fight between. It's so sad. And just like what the parents believe versus what she feels to be true. And
true.
And then, this is a fun part where like our heroes are together. They're now together. We've got Annie. We've got Sarah, Lisa, Warren, Hassan, and Aaron. These are our six heroes.
Yeah.
And they're through the door. They're in a room by themselves. And then they see that she's there. Okay. And Sarah goes, "You hid?" Because she is a dirty little coward.
Right. That's a great point.
She didn't want to see the carnage. She didn't want to be scared.
You're right.
She didn't want people to maybe be unceremoniously bitten by someone because she's a dirty little coward.
Yeah.
She's okay with it happening to everyone else. That's okay. That's part of God's plan, but not me. I'm something special, she thinks.
Yeah, and speaking of something special, we get some serious payoff right now because she's like, guns don't matter in this place because, you know, death is over. And
I'll just be 5 minutes behind you.
Yeah, if you shoot me right now, you'll only be putting me 5 minutes behind. And then Aaron does shoot her right in the stomach.
Yep.
And she's like, I just bought us 5 minutes.
I know. Yeah, clean up on aisle five.
It's just been revoked,
Bev. Do you know what I was literally thinking as they then all file out past her? I was like, I would have been okay if they had made the directive choice to have any one of them stomp on her. I would have been okay with that.
Oh, jeez, yeah. Like, I would have too.
Would have been like maybe it's a little bit gratuitous, but.
Maybe they could have disembodied her. Do you think she'd
disemboweled her?
Do you think she'd recover?
I guess it might take a bit longer.
Like, would her arms walk back to her body and stuff?
I know, but I think that she could just keep going. I think it would be like Monty Python, like, oh, it's just a flesh wound. Yeah, I think that's what it would be like.
Pretty much exactly like that. Just swap the bunny for the angel.
Yeah. And then, so this is the, remember I was talking about the like several frames that I love?
Oh,
is them
yes.
running away from the church.
Just running from the church.
Just our six heroes fucking hightailing it out of there. Everyone else is in there and they're like, we're getting the fuck out of here. I
that
just love it.
That was a good scene.
Just that moment of them all running through the dark. I'm like, yes. It's just like action.
And it just.
It's so great.
The tide turned in their direction just long enough for them to get out.
Yeah, yep. Just enough. It's like pump your fist in the air. Like, yes, there they go.
No kidding. And then they're just going to run to the mainland, I hope.
Yeah, let's hope. If they run fast enough.
Well, maybe they can, if you know, when better a time to walk on water than right now.
Yeah, once just one step out on the water.
Bev starts awake. She's like, you know what I mean? And feels her blood-soaked chest, sees the beautiful moving colors of the candlesticks now that she has the vampiric vision, whatever it is. She walks out into the pews and into the church proper, and we see just a very sad scene of a bunch of dead bodies, including a dead, very young little girl.
Okay, so here's another thing. So you can't have communion until a certain age,
right?
Is the other thing. So this would have been a bit grim. I don't blame them for not doing this. But what if the kids had been really and truly dead?
Was she? Did she stand
up? No, you see her wake up.
Okay.
And I think that they felt like they had to.
Because
putting a dead child on the screen for that length of time is, it's a choice in any movie or show. That would have been really grim and really dark.
It was really bothering me to see her. She was so beautiful.
She was gorgeous. Yeah. Gorgeous little thing stretched out. And like, you have kids similar age to that. Mm-hmm. So that's got to hit home especially.
Yes, I would certainly hate it if they were killed by vampires.
Oh, yeah, that would be. Yeah, I think you're unique in that.
I get it.
I personally would.
But no, it was impactful. I was having a hard time looking at it, frankly.
So I think that would have been another interesting thing. Because yeah, kids younger than a certain age can't receive communion. You can't receive communion until you get your first communion.
They'd be drunk.
Which I think is grade, like, 2 or 3-ish.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can't remember. I just know you have a big party and
you wear a pretty white dress, yeah.
Right? Sturge says he doesn't know what happened. Bev says it's okay. Do you think he didn't expect the bloodlust to come on like it did? He didn't understand that.
I think he probably didn't expect the carnage.
Yeah, that everyone just went feral.
Or you know what else? Maybe thought everyone would have drunk the poison and then everyone's on the same page. No one's eating each other.
No one's being eaten.
Instead, there were some people who were just full human still.
And were killed. Yeah.
Well, except that then they would have come back because they would have been churchgoers. Because they would have been churchgoers.
Of course. Okay. She says, open the doors and let them at it, basically. Even though Father Paul had said they're going to need to be guided when they wake up.
And this is the other part. Father Paul's awake. He's healing.
He's just kind of looking around.
But he says no. He shakes his head no at her. She goes, yeah, do it anyway.
Yeah.
She says, fuck that.
She's taking charge now. Those who have taken communion have nothing to fear. The others, let God sort them out. It's like, oh, she's so awful. Right? It's just, well, who cares if people die? I don't care. You know, they didn't take communion.
Exactly. If they're not religious, they're not worth living.
She's such an excellent villain.
Oh, she's great.
They needed someone to play the villain other than Father Paul, because Father Paul is really the villain and so is the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed someone with a villain's attitude.
So credit to Samantha Sloyan for her performance.
Masterful performance. I hope I never meet her. I hate her.
It's incredibly memorable. Do you know who else is a performance like that? Is Imelda Staunton, who played, what's her name? The mean one from Harry Potter 5.
Oh, Umbridge.
Umbridge, yep.
She's another classic villain, because you're just like, oh, I hate her.
Credit to Samantha Sloyan, amazing performance.
She's amazing, yeah, absolutely.
And like, oh, just, it's got to take a certain kind of performer to jump in with both feet to such a hateful character.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think of others. I know I've compared her to Miss Carmody before. If that's how you say her name.
Yeah. From The Mist. It's just like such a, I don't know, it's such an art, you know?
Yep, 100%.
There's sometimes that you watch people in a performance and you can think, oh, yeah, that's great. But you also think it's probably not too far from how they are in real life. And you think, oh, this is great. I like watching it. Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily seem like a challenge or a feat of skill.
Right.
And yet this kind of thing does, because you're like, ooh, you really nailed it.
So nasty.
Yeah, you really nailed it.
So any final thoughts on this episode? I thought it was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was a little less to talk about because it is like action.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Probably right. There's a bit less to talk about from the perspective of mental health, and yet we always find opportunities.
We always find something, baby.
But I think it's great. I think that if this and the next one were a movie, like that's the way it feels. Mm. It feels like it's just go straight into the next one.
Yeah.
It's almost like a part one and two of the climax.
Oh, certainly.
Because this feels like we're really in the climax here.
This is like the last book in a dystopian series that's been split into two movies. into two movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is The Mockingjay part one, part two.
great
episode. Like, yeah, no more Riley, which is, I almost feel sad that Zach Guilford didn't get to like participate in this bit of it, because
maybe
it's just so fun.
Maybe they didn't shoot them sequentially.
No, I'm sure they didn't. But like, just because he was such a, like, Riley was such an important force in the narrative. And
yeah, he brought a lot of heart.
It's just like his memory now over this. But it's like, it's great. This episode was great. And I can't wait for the next one. That is the plot hole that I spoke about in the church is an important one that was really nagging at me. So I'm glad that I got to speak about it.
Yeah.
But I love this story. And like, remember I was talking to you recently how, because we've been recording this series, it feels like I've been living in the world of Midnight Mass for months.
For some time, yeah.
Because we've just been thinking about it so deeply and doing all this. And it's been really fun. And it just really makes me think how great this narrative is, and this world building, and this world that it's in, that the more time I've sat with it, the more meaningful it's become to me. So I think that's, instead of, you know, if you look too closely at some things, they lose meaning.
They don't hold up as well.
They don't hold up under scrutiny. Whereas I feel the opposite here.
Yeah, I agree 100%. This show is awesome.
It's great.
Incredible. And it's taken a huge turn now where it was not slow, because I'm always enjoying every episode, but the pace is just really rocketed, you know, into the stratosphere, and now it's a different thing.
Yeah, now it's
now
a different
show.
Now
it's not about the character-driven this and that. Now it's about, okay, there's this very present threat, there's death all over the place, there's violence, and now all the horror elements are coming to the fore, right?
Yep.
So I agree. I can't sing the praises of this series too much, I think. Yeah, I thought there were some interesting aspects of mental health as well that we discussed. Like, you could spend some time talking about gaslighting as well, because there were some times where, because everyone is in on this trick, people are kind of trying to make people feel like what they're thinking is ridiculous and quote-unquote crazy. So Sturge to the women and all this stuff. But yeah, really excited to talk about the next one. Guys, we hope you will join us for the finale, what has been a long time coming, of our Midnight Mass series. And want to thank you so much for joining us for this one.
Yeah, thank you for sticking with us. Bye.
Take care.
I don't think he's well. It's no surprise to you or me or anybody else.
You're basing this on a third-hand account from Riley Flynn. Hardly the most reliable person on the island.
Yes. The answer is yes. Riley wasn't well, isn't well.
There will be others, like Riley. There always are, who try to poison the ears of the faithful against their God.
Maybe he's on a bender. Maybe he's taken the ferry to the mainland. He's just in a bad place. Don't assume the worst. In fact, hey, assume the best.